Welcome back into the Red Zone Podcast. My name is Colton Bartholomew, UW football beat reporter here for the Wisconsin State Journal, joined by longtime basketball and football beat reporter Jim Polzine. And got a kind of busy week going on. We're heading into tournament time. We got pro day for football coming up. Lots of stuff to talk about. Jim, just as you wrap up another regular season here and you're heading into another postseason, just what's this type of year, what time of year like for you every year?
It's always usually a pretty exciting time. I mean, like, chaotic but slash exciting, just because, like, I think I've mentioned this on previous shows that it's the uncertainty of knowing where you're going to be and stuff is always a little bit unnerving. And this year it's different. Like, I'm not sitting around on Sunday watching the selection show wondering I have to immediately book a flight to San Jose or Albuquerque or something, you know. I'll be going to the greater Indianapolis area, so that makes it better. But it just this whole covering this team and these games in a pandemic setting is just, it's weird, right? You just haven't talked one-on-one, you know, in person to anybody since probably since this shortly after the season ended or right before the Big Ten tournament last year, I think is my last in-person interview. And that's just, it's, you know, it's just, I hate that about this season. That's been the toughest part.
No, absolutely. And on top of it, that the frustration of, seem to be boiling over in the last week or so with this team. We're going to get into that, especially here on this show. Give you a quick rundown. We're going to talk about Greg Gard kind of going off on the officials and the Big Ten with the reviews and the Brad Davison situation Sunday against Iowa. We're going to also talk about just this postseason now for the Badgers. You've got Big Ten tournament coming up this weekend. We're recording this Wednesday morning. The Badgers play Thursday night. Talk about where they're looking at NCAA tournament wise with Selection Sunday on Sunday. We're going to fill out our Big Ten brackets and talk about why we're picking who, and then do a quick primer on UW football's pro day. Just talk about who's the pro day most important for, with about 10, 12 guys there, a little bit of a bigger group than there was last season, I feel like. So lots of stuff to get into, and we'll do all that right after this. All right, Jim, we got to start with what everybody's been talking about the last few days. Greg Gard Sunday afternoon after what really was just a travesty of an officiating situation where you have this awesome game. The Badgers in Iowa are going back and forth. It's super close. And then it's been circulating all week. The final minute of game time took 20 real minutes. Absolutely no flow. It was play, five-minute review. It was crazy. And then after the game, Greg Gard, who is normally pretty, I would say, respectful, if not like kind of hands off with the refs. Like he's never a guy that's going to put things on the refs after a loss or things like that, just goes off on them. And it all kind of stemmed from the one play with Brad Davison where he's on offense trying to catch a pass and gets called for a hook and hold. I mean, you were watching the game closely and you were talking to him. Just kind of give us your take on the situation as a whole, and then we'll dive into it a little bit more specifically.
Yeah, there's a couple of things here. Like, I was not expecting him to do what he did. I think that was, you know, that he broke character to do that. I certainly had some questions teed up for him about the officiating, and I did ask him about the Trice play, which he said he hadn't seen and had no comment on. That to me, in real time, was the one that looked the most questionable and was ultimately a huge call. I mean, if there's no call there, Wisconsin has the ball in a tie game, maybe with the ability to run the clock down almost to the end. But instead, Bo Borowski calls a foul. Bohannon gets three free throws. Iowa takes the lead. And then the Davison stuff happens after that. So I thought that was the bigger call. And even after watching the game again and watching that play a couple times, I personally don't think it was a foul. I think they blew that one. I've had some Iowa fans reach out and admit that they thought it was a soft call on Trice. And it was his fifth foul too.
And the bigger part of that is that fouled him out. So then Wisconsin loses their best offensive player, the guy that's been their most clutch player all season long for this stretch run against a really good team.
Right. And even after watching the game, I mean, the person I feel like should be most angry about the way he was treated was Trice. Cause there was a couple other questionable calls. There was a no call, a no call that Bohannon kind of used his arm to extend and shove Trice out of the way, right in front of Borowski again. Nothing gets called. Bohannon makes a three-pointer late in the game. So there, I thought if anybody should have been mad, it should have been Trice. The Davison thing to me, you know, I think is, I don't know that it was so much that play. I think it was a you know, it was things adding up over time and Greg Gard finally snapping because he feels like he's being, that he feels like Davison's being targeted. You know, the funny thing was after watching that game, hearing during Davison's free throws, or as he's getting ready to take free throws, hearing Gard just tear into Borowski, using some pretty foul language to tear into him. So I think this was something that had been building up. They're tired of everything. Something happens with Brad and it goes to the review monitor, you know, and that happens over and over. Here's the thing about the hook and hold that I'll say. Two people can look at the same play and come up with completely different conclusions. And, you know, I look at that play and I don't have that huge of a problem with them calling hook and hold there. Davison clamps down his arm and kind of traps Murray's arm, you know, within it. It's a completely unnatural play. And let's face it, Brad Davison's not going to get the benefit of the doubt. Like, it's just not going to happen. He's already been suspended by the league for what it's deemed a pattern of similar behavior. So officials, whether it's Bo Borowski or DJ Carstensen or Courtney Green, the three officials the other day, they're not going to go to the monitor and give Brad Davison the benefit of the doubt where they might in a different player's case. So I didn't have as much problem with that play. I do understand why Greg Gard goes to bat for his players. And I think it did have a pretty positive effect on how his players see him. At least they're saying the right things in regard to that.
Yeah, I want to start with the first overall point there. I think that's a headline that makes Gard the most upset, is that because of things that happened in the past, and it's a human nature thing, like officials are people too, but in Greg Gard's mind, and I think it's a fair case, you have to look at the play individually in absent of who is involved. You just have to see Wisconsin player and Iowa player. And I do think that there's probably a fair case to be made that officials aren't doing that. And when they see Davis involved in the play, I think they go into it assuming that he's doing something that's not within the rules, which, you know, multiple things in Davison's career here at Wisconsin, you can argue, well, that was just, you know, wasn't dirty versus was dirty, you know, and that's a debate for a separate day. But I think Gard's frustration comes from the fact that refs aren't supposed to hold stuff against players like that. And I think it's fair to say that they are. And we've talked about on the podcast before, like, he's a lightning rod. Like, officials know when they call a Wisconsin game, like, he's going to try to bait them into giving him charges. He's going to do some things, you know, on the ball defensively that's, I don't deem it dirty. It's very physical, and it's stuff that a guy that's a veteran in this league knows that he can get away with at times. And maybe it's one of those things where officials are frustrated too, because it's like, you make this so hard to officiate you, and you play this way, eventually it's going to go against you. And then, I don't know, I think there's just a lot of, but both sides saying, we're not coming into this with a neutral mindset.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And see, when I've watched Wisconsin games over and over this year, I have less problem with the hook and hold stuff than I think Brad Davison is not getting whistles on drives to the basket, right? I think there's a lot of times where there's a lot of contact and he's not getting the whistle, which it makes me wonder whether that's officials holding a grudge for previous stuff, which, again, I agree with you, that's completely wrong. In regards to the hook and hold, I think another thing that's happening is opponents are he's on their radar and they immediately realize who it is. Like, I don't know if that's Tyler Wall drawing that contact from Murray, if Murray immediately points out that, oh, you know, he held me or he hooked me or whatever, because he does. He immediately goes and makes a point. And that's, I think, why the officials look at it in the first place. And then you're probably right. I mean, they're walking over without even seeing the play. You have to wonder whether they have already made up their mind because of who it is involved. And so I do get the frustration there. You'd like every game to start with a clean slate, regardless of what's happened in the past. But I think there's also some human nature going on that it's hard to do that.
Yeah. And I think there's also with the hook and hold just from a general penalty standpoint, is that, and you brought it up before, two guys or two referees can go to the monitor and see two separate things. And when you slow it down, it becomes even harder. It's almost like you shouldn't be allowed to slow-mo it. Like, you should have to look at it in real time. And it's a little bit like targeting in college football too, because anytime you slow the play down, you're going to see, okay, maybe the two helmets collided after the shoulders hit, but maybe like the obviously the helmet hit's going to be more impactful, or maybe the helmet hit like a very split second before the shoulder was, and there was no intent, but then you still have to call a penalty. It's just, we want rules in sports to be far more objective than they are subjective. And this is one of those things that when you slow it down a bunch of times and you look at it over and over, you kind of just have to make a decision that maybe doesn't reflect what actually happened in real time. And I don't entirely agree with Greg Gard's point that officials have made this like the Brad Davison rule. They're always looking at Davison for the hook and hold, because we've seen in a lot of other games that these hook and hold calls are kind of, I wouldn't say taking over, but they, people are trying to bait. It's almost becoming another block charge where guys are trying to bait guys into grabbing their arm as they're doing other things and then getting that flagrant. So I do think that this is going to change. I feel like this offseason is going to get looked at pretty hard. But just from an overall thing here, the hook and hold is just a little bit too hard to officiate. And it's not something that the intent was good. It's just in execution, it's not working.
Yeah, and I think another big picture thing is they've given officials one more thing to complicate things, whether it's the hook and hold, whether it's the flop rule. I've seen the flop rule so badly misused and bad calls on that this year. And not this is not just a Brad Davison thing or a Wisconsin thing, in all games where a guy will try to draw a charge, there's obvious contact there, the guy falls to the ground and he's given a flop warning. And an official has to decide in real time whether the guy is trying to deceive him or, you know, and as it turns out, when you watch the play again, there's actual contact there. So my point is that officials just have so much more to look at now, and it's become so hard, and they're missing other stuff that is supposed to be in the rules of the game. 3 seconds in the rule in the lane drives me nuts now, because some of these guys are allowed to just to camp out in the lane. And that's, again, that's a punishment towards the defense if you allow the offensive player just to sit in the lane for 4 or 5 seconds. But the officials have so much going on around them that you're going to miss some stuff. And I think they're starting to miss some of the little stuff, you know, the easy stuff, the physical play in the post, the 3 seconds in the lane. And because, you know, they have so much to look out for, it's become harder to officiate, which is why I try to give these guys a benefit of the doubt to a certain degree, because I know it's a hard job. But, you know, I think little things are being missed. And there's, frankly, I'll tell you, I've heard more about Big Ten officiating this year from fans than any other year. And I think there's something to that, in that they've had to shrink the crew to a certain degree because of the pandemic. They've lost some pretty veteran officials to other leagues. And I think the overall quality of the Big Ten officials has gone way down. Like, for as much crap as Borowski gets, he's one of the most experienced guys in the league now. He'll probably end up doing a lot of NCAA tournament games, because I'm guessing he's going to be one of the more highly rated officials in the Big Ten, in part by default, because I look around that league and I don't see a lot of great officials anymore. And that's sad, because it's a really good league from a player standpoint and a quality standpoint. You'd like the officials to be among the best in the game too, and I just don't know if that's the case.
Yeah. And that's a great point, because it's hilarious to watch, like, when the lead up to a game and you tweet out the officials and then people lose their minds when they see Borowski. And I get it. And I think you laid it out really well. It's like, okay, yeah, the Badgers are what, like 2-6 this year with Borowski as an official?
2-8 overall, 0-7 in Big Ten play.
Okay. But then I'm trying to remember the follow-up. I should have pulled up before I start talking here, but 5 of those 6 losses, or almost all of those losses, are against like the Iowas, the Michigans, the Illinois, like teams that they were going to lose to more than likely anyway. This Iowa game becomes the focal point because it was so close, and then it became a ref show at the end. But these other games, like, you could have the best ref out there, Wisconsin's still probably going to lose.
Right. I mean, as we've seen, there's other deficiencies with this team that makes it hard for them to win against the good team. The only outlier was at Penn State that game. Yeah. That was a game that Wisconsin, you know, is probably better than the opponent and lost, and Brodsky's on the crew. And again, I'd have to go back and look again. I don't remember officiating. I don't remember walking away from that game saying that officiating was the reason they lost it. There were a lot of other things going on. I actually went back the other day and charted the foul calls. You know, in a perfect world, you'd like a 1-to-1 ratio, right? The same number of fouls on Wisconsin, same number as Iowa, right? Borowski was actually the closest of the three to that. He called six on Wisconsin, 5 on Iowa. Courtney Green was 6 on Wisconsin, 3 on Iowa. DJ Carstensen was 8 on Wisconsin, 4 on Iowa. Now, what I'll say to that is Borowski, even though his ratio is closest to 1-to-1, he had some really questionable calls among those. The most questionable calls were his whistle, and frankly, some no calls. I thought that he didn't call. Like here's one example. First half, Johnny Davis gets called for a charge. His first charge. He got called for two charges. The first one, he drives in and kind of pushes off with his arm, and I thought at the time, pretty good call. But later on, as I mentioned before, Bohannon does almost the same thing with Trice as a defender. Bobrovsky's in the exact same spot, standing right in front of the Iowa bench. That's a no call. And to me, it looked like a very, very similar play where you know, if you're going to call it one way the first time, you should call it one way the second time. And again, the Trice fall on the Bohannon three-pointer, I thought was extremely questionable, especially at that point in the game. So I understand why people are mad. I mean, it's hard to prove that someone has it out for your team, though. I mean, I don't even know how you do that. A lot of people have posted, the fouls are in favor of the other team in games that Borowski, you know, refs. But again, I think a lot of that goes back to the opponent. You know, I think teams like Illinois and Michigan and Iowa are more aggressive. They're doing a better job. They have better players. They're doing a better job of drawing fouls. And so naturally that foul count is going to be higher.
Sure, for sure. You guys spoke with Greg Gard and a couple of players on Tuesday, and you mentioned it off the top. It seemed like this is going to have at least some type of positive effect, or at least the players are saying that, and reading Jim's story, which you can find on Madison.com, about, you know, the way that the guard going to bat for Davidson and kind of standing up to what the players and guard think is wrong with the officiating. It seemed to light a fire a little bit as they head into the postseason, coming off of not only 3 straight losses in the regular season, but then 5 of 6 to end the regular season. So kind of sputtering to the finish, but maybe this is the spark that they needed.
That's something. I mean, again, like I'm skeptical. I want to see it first. Like I want to see that it has an impact. I want to see, you know, I think too often this season I've walked away from games thinking that this team hasn't shown enough fight, you know, not that they've, I think the other team, I always come away thinking the other team played harder, a little bit harder. A lot of times the other team was better talent wise, but I just thought, like, you know, they played harder, and I want to see this team kind of fight to the finish. I want to see this team show some urgency in the postseason. You know, a lot of it comes down to making shots. I get that, but I think there's a lot of little things that Wisconsin can do to rebounding, 50-50 ball, stuff like that, that, you know, that can keep them in the game. And then, you know, knock on wood, they make some shots and the results flip a little bit.
Sure. So let's jump into talking about the postseason a little bit here. So we mentioned the 3 straight losses end of the year. Silver lining there, they're against really good teams, and they were close. Wisconsin was in all of those games, and that was a difference from kind of, I feel like, in the middle of the conference season where they're losing by double digits or, you know, 8-9 points and stuff like that. What do you think has kind of turned, especially offensively, because it seems like they're, at least in some of these, for longer stretches of these games, they're able to score. They're avoiding some of these massive scoring droughts that we've seen at times this year where the game gets away from them.
Yeah, I mean, the efficiency numbers, especially the last 2 games, have been much better. And then if you throw in that last, you know, 2 minutes or maybe the last 5 minutes against Illinois, it's been a lot better. I think some of it just comes down simply to making shots. But I do think, you know, Greg Gard mentioned this yesterday. I think the cutting's a little bit sharper. The screens are a little bit more physical and, you know, technically sound, I guess you'd say. I just think a lot of the little things were slipping away from this team. and they've done that a little bit better offensively. The movement is better. You know, it's not so stagnant. Greg Gard talked about how there's less dribbling. You know, the good offenses move the ball through the air and not on the ground, you know, not on the dribble. So I think there's some of that. They're getting a little bit easier baskets at times. Now, if they can just, as crazy as it sounds, I still think this team can get hot from 3-point range. I look at that game the other day and I think they end up shooting like 37, 38% from three because they got hot in the second half, but I counted 10 great looks, like some of them wide open, some of them what I would classify as, you know, not quite wide open, but open. And they missed 10 of those, right? Like you should be, I don't know what the percentage should be on wide open 3-pointers, but it can't be 0%. And if it's closer to 50%, they win that game comfortably, right? So, you know, again, maybe their hot streak this year comes a little bit later and they can put it together in the postseason and make a run. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to predict that based on the way things have gone, but I think that's, you know, I think that's the only, this team's only chance is if they start knocking down some 3-point shots.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to be optimistic, they got to be due at some point. Like if you look at this, the law of averages here, at some point they should have, with how poorly they've shot at times this season from three, there's got to be a couple of week stretch where they get really hot, right, to kind of balance it out. But, you know, obviously the tournament times would be a couple of good weeks to have that happen. But I think it kind of goes to the idea of this team hasn't been what we thought. Can they, you know, for lack of a better term, flip the switch? Can they find something that gets them going? Maybe this kind of us against the refs, us against the world mentality that's sparked up this week becomes part of that. But I don't know. I'm typically not somebody that thinks, especially if you don't have an elite talent, like, you know, just make an NBA comparison. Like the Lakers could play like garbage for 3 months going into the postseason, but they still have LeBron James, right? They still got the best player. So they can, you can presume they would be able to find a way to get it done. I don't think Wisconsin has that level of talent. And you've said it a few times in the podcast, like for this team to be that elite level, it's got to be five or six guys all playing well. They don't have one or two that can just carry everybody. And that's, I feel like that's what the season has been about. Like most of the time it's been Trice, every now and again Potter. I don't see it happening where, you know, Ford, Jonathan Davis off the bench, Reavers, all these guys somehow click it all together for the postseason here and make a run. But I think that's what would have to happen for it to happen.
I totally agree. And the thing is, I think I said this a couple of weeks ago, was, you know, the league's grown up around them and they haven't, right? They haven't gotten better. They are who they were last season. If you compare the efficiency numbers this year to last, it's pretty similar. It's not like they've dropped off a ton. Their 3-point numbers were a little bit down in 3-point in Big Ten play. But they're largely the same team they were last year. And the problem is, everybody's gotten better around them. All the good teams got better. And so, you know, you look at them now against Iowa, against Illinois, against Michigan, Ohio State, Purdue, they're not as good as those teams and would need to play almost a perfect game to beat them and similar teams like them, right? Like, I just think there's a upper echelon of teams in the country that they're not as good as and would have to have, you know, kind of a magic to happen to beat those teams. It's not impossible, but it's really hard to expect it to happen.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think this Big Ten tournament's pretty big when you consider where the Badgers are sitting in bracketology and where people project them. Joe Lunardi, I don't know if he's like from Wisconsin or if his wife's from Wisconsin or something, but he has been super reluctant to drop them down. I mean, he still has them on his 7 line, which is by far the highest of anybody that's really, you know, a respected name in this, in bracketology as a whole. Everybody else is at them, at least on the 8, a couple on the 9. And you don't want to be in that 8 or 9 line because not only do you have a team that's pretty similar to you, at least resume-wise, in that first round, so it's going to be an even matchup. Then in that second round, if you get there, you know, in all times but one, you're playing the number one seed. And it's looking like it'll either be the Gonzaga number one overall seed bracket for the Badgers or the Baylor one. And when you just look at athletically and the way they've played all year, the Badgers have very little ways to match up with those teams on defense or offense, really.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, you know, like all along, I've kind of said, well, you know, yes, they're not among the elite in the Big Ten, but if they can end up in that 6 or 7 seed range somehow, you know, win a couple of those games down the stretch, and end up on that 6 or 7 seed line, then, you know, there's still a chance to make a run. But I think if you get in that 8-9 range, you're right. Maybe you win a game. I mean, maybe you don't. But it's hard to see them get into the second weekend out of the 8 or 9 seed list. It's just they've kind of played themselves into a tough spot here. And I'm not sure what it would take exactly to – I mean, what do you think from a seeding standpoint is the ceiling at this point? Like if they would beat a Penn State, which, again, if you look at net rankings, that would still be considered a pretty quality win.
Yeah, it'd be a quad one.
Penn State, and then beat Iowa, and then lose to Illinois. Is that where does that put them? Still in the 7 line, you think?
Yeah, I think if you beat Illinois, you've got to beat one of the elite guys. You've got to beat Illinois. I would say Iowa and Illinois. I would say to get up above 7 or 8, or excuse me, above 8, just because their resume. They have enough quality wins here in the Big Ten against that middle tier that they're going to be in the tournament, but they've really only beat, when I was looking up, like 3 or 4 tournament teams, and one of them is Loyola Chicago, and that was in non-conference in December. So, I mean, the resume is not super strong unless they have a great tournament run here in the Big Ten tournament to push them up above where they're sitting right now. So I think you have to beat Illinois and Iowa. So that would put them in the Big Ten championship game. To get above that 8 line, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's probably fair. I mean, the only thing I'd say is, and I haven't, you know, guys like Lunardi and Jerry Palm look into this stuff. I haven't compared them to other teams kind of in that 7, 8, 9 range. And my guess is that those teams also have similarly mediocre resumes too, right?
It's a lot of the Big 12. It's a lot of the middle tier of the Big 12 that, you know, their losses are against teams like Baylor or when I think Oklahoma State, stuff like that, where it's quality losses and a couple of decent wins against similar teams. So, like I said, that's your first round matchup. There is no at least penciling yourself into the second round. It's going to be a dogfight in that first round.
Yeah, they've really played themselves into a tough spot here. Like I said, if they could have just won a couple down the stretch, I really thought like, you know, I really thought that if they could be a 6 seed, they'd be a dangerous 6 seed, because I looked at a lot of those 3 seeds and thought, you know, there's, once you get past the top 6 or 7 teams, maybe I think 7 through 25, 7 through 30 are pretty equal. But you know, once you get down to that 8 or 9, you've left yourself with a really tough second round opponent if you even get there.
Yeah. And I think really it goes back to they could have all avoided this. And even if they would have lost these ranked games toward the end of the season, that Penn State game, was it Rutgers or Maryland? I always thought these
Maryland,
two.
Maryland at home.
Maryland at home. That's a killer. You just take those 2 losses out and you're 18-8 at that point instead of 16-10.
18-9 right now.
18-9. I mean, that looks a lot better. When you look at not double-digit losses heading into your conference tournament. So we'll see what happens here this weekend. Jim's going to be down in Indianapolis covering it all. Let's jump into now the Big Ten tournament. We're going to fill out our brackets here, what we think is going to happen, talk about why we think that. Let's start with tonight's games, Jim. We got Minnesota and Northwestern, and then Nebraska taking on Penn State in the first round here on Wednesday. Who do you got in those games?
I'm picking Northwestern over Minnesota. Liam Robbins is not going to play again. Gabe Kelscher is not going to play again. Richard Pitino, I think, might, by the time if people are going to listen to this on Friday, he might not have a job at that point, because I think it's going to move pretty quickly. And it's, from the sounds of it, he's going to be out of a job. So I think Northwestern's look better late in the year. They're going to win that game. And then I'm taking Penn State over Nebraska. Nebraska's actually looked better since their top scorer, Teddy Allen, left the program abruptly. But I still think Penn State's got more talent. It's going to win that game.
I am in complete agreement on both of the picks and reasons. I think Minnesota, not that they're quitting on the season, but they know what the eventual end here. If it's not Thursday morning or Friday morning, they know the coach is getting changed. A lot of these guys are leaving. And I know that they were hurt, but I think if this was a decent team, a lot of these guys would be on the floor tonight trying to, you know, save the season.
I do wonder that. I mean, it's weird. Quick aside, remember how we talked a couple weeks ago about the difficulty in picking all Big Ten teams?
Yeah.
How, you know, the league's ballot, the league's official ballot, you don't have to worry about positions, but the AP ballot, you kind of are supposed to consider positions. Well,
yep.
Marcus Carr ended up being a first team all Big Ten player on the AP team, in large part because I think people freaked out and needed to put a guard on there. I did not vote for him. I had a hard time voting for someone who, you know, whose team finishes poorly as that. So he was not on my first team, but he did make first team all Big Ten, which meant, you know, some really good players like Hunter Dickinson and Kofi Coburn, I believe, did not make the first team.
Right. I love seeing the all Big Ten, the conferences list, having three centers on the first team. I was a big fan.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? I mean, like, I actually have gone back and forth, but a part of it's like, if just choose the five best players, right?
Agreed. Yeah. That's how I feel about it.
Right. But then again, like I was questioning myself because football actually does positions,
yep.
You know, let's say you're a third team All-American quarterback, you still might end up being a third team All-American All Big Ten, because there's two guys that are better than you and it doesn't matter because of the position. So I don't know how I feel about it. I just know it was much easier to pick best five instead of having to force some guards in a year where this league was very forward and center heavy.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. I think it should reflect who was the best players on the floor regardless. And I mean, this is a rare case because we're pushing so fast toward positionless basketball, right?
Right.
But then this year, too, when you've got these three, you know, monsters at your fives that are crazy productive on both ends and were so impactful on their teams in every game they played, I mean, it's hard not to recognize them and have them reflect that. So,
yeah.
All right, so let's jump into the second round. You get in the first bye teams. We got Michigan State playing Maryland. What do you got there, Jim?
I'm taking Michigan State. They've been playing really well down the stretch. I don't think they necessarily need this game. I think they're in right now, but I think it would be, you know, they'd have to sweat it out the last couple of days if they do lose to Maryland. I think they're going to win.
Yeah, it's crazy. It happens every year. Izzo figures it out no matter how bleak it looks at some points, but I'm with you there that they're probably in the tournament regardless because of their big signature wins, but don't add a question mark here at the end of the year or at the beginning of the postseason and kind of muddy it up. So I'm with you on Michigan State. That jumps us down into Northwestern playing Ohio State. I'm on Ohio State there. I mean, Northwestern, like you said, they've played well. As tough as their record looks, they actually have hung in a lot of their games, but Ohio State needs to have a decent showing here in the Big Ten tournament to make sure they don't fall, you know, below the two line.
Yeah, I was going to say they've lost four in a row heading into the postseason. I almost think like this dropping to the 5-12 game is okay for them. They need a win.
Hmm.
You know, had they been a four, you're probably looking at playing Purdue in that first game with a chance for another loss. And then you head in the NCAA tournament with five straight losses. So I think this team needs to just kind of, it needs a good feeling from a win. And I think they'll beat Northwestern.
Sure. All right. And then the next game on Thursday will be Indiana versus Rutgers. I'm on Rutgers there. They played two times and they're both relatively close games. I thought Indiana was going to make a push in February. They I can't remember who they beat. They hung close to Ohio State and that kind of made me think that they were going to be there, but didn't fully materialize. So I'm going Rutgers.
I am too. And that's another thing where I just think that, you know, Rutgers just plays harder and Indiana yeah. down the stretch just looks like a team that has, again, like you said about the Minnesota Patino, it's not like they stopped playing for Archie Miller, but it just seems like they're missing something. And other than Trace Jackson Davis, you don't know who you're going to count on night to night. So I'm taking Rutgers as well.
Gotcha. All right. That gives us a Thursday night where Penn State, in our bracket at least, will be taking on Wisconsin. I've got Wisconsin there. I think they know how to beat this team. I think they're trying to prove themselves and make sure that they can, you know, salvage something out of this season. And, you know, if you lose to a Penn State here, you might be talking about a 9 or a 10 for Wisconsin heading to the tournament, just because the losses of the last month have been pretty quality. That's not a quality loss to a Penn State.
No, I can totally see it happening, though. I think this is a scary game. I really do. I'm picking Wisconsin, but I think it's a scary game because Penn State's got some guys that can get hot. They've got John Hara in the middle, who is just a hard worker, and you know, he's really going to put Micah Potter and Nate Reavers to the test. I think Wisconsin needs a win here. You know, the funny thing is, if they lose this game, I don't know that they could fall any lower than a 10. But if they end up in the 11 game, that's actually a better. If you end up in the 6-11 game, to me, that's better than being an 8 or 9 game, right? So it's almost like, you know, dropping would not be the worst thing in the world. I just don't think they can drop as low as an 11 seed.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there. All right, so that goes us, or takes us into Friday, where we have Michigan State playing Michigan. Michigan was top overall seed. I know they just beat, I know the Spartans just beat Michigan. I can't imagine that happens twice in 2 weeks. They're going to want some payback, Michigan is. And getting a little rest here probably will help Michigan after they played a couple of games, you know, in a quick span after that long COVID break they had. So I'm on Michigan there.
Yeah, this is such a weird setup. This will be the third time these teams have met in 8 days.
Oh, yeah. Jeez.
So, I mean, familiarity, it's going to be interesting. But I agree with you. One thing we should mention here is that the Lucas Oil Stadium is a weird setup for these games, right? I mean, they're going to have two courts set up and only play on one in the Big Ten. They're getting the two courts set up for the NCAA tournament play, but the Big Ten will only play on one of them. They'll be kind of curtained off. I think part of the stadium will be curtained off. There are going to be fans there, but, you know, I think like 10 or 11% capacity. I'm curious to see how all these teams adjust to this, to a big arena that they're going to try to make look smaller. I don't know. I think there's going to be some adjustment period. Which brings me to my point that if you've got a chance to play a game, if you're playing your second game and the other team's playing its first game, I wonder if that's any sort of advantage. I'm not going to pick Michigan State, but I do think that all these matchups we're going to talk about from this point forward, if that plays a role at all, if you're the team playing its second, like even the Penn State Wisconsin game, right? Penn State will have a game under its belt. Wisconsin won't. Does that make a difference, you know, in terms of just being comfortable with the court? We'll see.
That's a really good point. I didn't even think about that. And I think that I saw a diagram of that setup with the split court. And honestly, it looked like an AAU tournament where like they've got a massive gym and they divided a bunch of courts. And I mean, guys are so used to that at this level of play, but I think it's going to be really weird for fans at home watching these games.
Yeah. I'm interested to see how it looks. And even like I'm going down there, I think they're going to have us on the baseline somewhere. I'm curious how, you know, it's going to be interesting this tournament and the next one. How about the next one where there's two courts, you know, and
yeah, it's bizarre. Yeah, no, for sure. All right. So that takes us to what we have as the Ohio State Purdue game. This is probably the hardest one for me to pick as I was filling this out. I'm going with Purdue. I don't feel super strongly about it. I really liked Ohio State. I haven't liked how they finished the regular season. Obviously I liked how they played, and I think they're one of the tougher teams to guard because they don't have, I would say, like, they kind of throw out three or four guys that you would call like forward wings, and they're all really athletic and pretty strong. And I just think that Purdue's got not only the momentum, but their, I always forget his name, Edie, the 7'2" guy.
Yeah,
Edie. So I just think that he's got an advantage. And I'm thinking back to that awesome Ohio State Michigan game where Dickinson was really a force down low because of his height. So I'm going to go with Purdue there, but I don't have like a great, you know, backup for it.
Yeah, this is really getting boring because we're agreeing with each other for every game, but I agree with you. And Zach Edey was the guy I was going to mention. He's really figured something out late in the year. He's a pretty good player all the season long, but I think you can see a pretty big growth late in the year. The Wisconsin game, he certainly dominated Wisconsin. Indiana, he looked really good too. I think they figured out how to use him better. You're right. Ohio State's weakness is that it just doesn't have big guys that can match these big centers in the league. And that's a problem. And that's why I think Purdue's going to win.
It's funny though. I think that gives Ohio State an advantage when they get to the tournament, because I think there are more teams around the country. Like the Big Ten's, I think, a rarity right now that they have this dominant center position across multiple schools. I think Ohio State's a team that even if they don't have a great showing here in the Big Ten, like, I think they have a chance to make a run just because they play a little bit more similar to the rest of the country, but we'll have to see how that goes. Later on Friday, what we have is Rutgers versus Illinois. I think Illinois, there's no answer for Coburn, and then Io DeSumo is back. So I think Illinois is primed up for a run here. So I got Illinois.
I do too. Illinois has just, I mean, what amazed me down the stretch is that they lose their best player and win some really tough games on the road despite him. Andre Curbelo, who I thought looked awful down in the game in Champaign with Wisconsin, he's been great down the stretch. Gives them another ball maker, playmaker, ball handler and playmaker. They've got a little bit of everything, and I like the way they play. They play hard. I mean, that's the thing. They've got talent, but they play really, really hard.
Sure. And then that would take us to Friday night, which we have as the Wisconsin-Iowa game. I'll give Wisconsin credit for playing as hard as they did Sunday and keeping as close as they did. I just think Iowa's a better team. I'm going to go with Iowa.
I do too. The only thing that would make me change my mind is if Joe Wieskamp's not available, if that ankle isn't ready, or if he's limited. I think that evens it out a little bit more. But if Iowa's at full strength, they're the better team and playing well. Like I think, you know, we might have mentioned this last week. Defensively, they're better. I mean, it's not necessarily in the second half the other day, but they've gotten better defensively, and that's the thing that's scary about them and could lead to a long run in March, is that, you know, they're going to get offense. You know, you've got shooters and inside game. You've got everything offensively you need, but can you defend? And they've shown they can defend a little bit better. They're not elite by any means, but they've gotten better in that department. And you know, I think that's why they're among the elite in the nation.
Yeah, for a team like that, a couple of stops is a 6-0, 9-0 run that can swing a game. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the way they play offense. So that takes us into Saturday, where we have Michigan taking on Purdue. It'll be interesting to see the Dickinson-Edie matchup, because Dickinson might beat him up early in the season, but now with Edie coming on a little bit, I still like Michigan there. I just think that they're playing about as well as anybody in the country. I think that they're primed for a big run in the NCAA tournament too, and I think it starts here. So I go Michigan there.
Yeah, I'm a little hesitant because Michigan didn't play great down the stretch after the break, but I think I agree with you, what you said before, that a little break here might help get their legs back, and you know, maybe some just practice at this time of year is good, just to kind of, you know, get back to doing things you want to do. So I think it's gonna be a close game, but I like Michigan as well.
Sure. And then that would take us to what we both have, is Illinois versus Iowa in the other semifinal. This was tough for me because I think, yeah, the Wieskamp thing is a pretty significant factor in this one. I still just don't think there's anybody on Iowa that can hang with the Sunmu. And I think he would be the one that needs to have a huge game, because not that Garza can, you know, keep Coburn off the boards or, you know, out physical him. I just think he can make him work on defense enough that maybe tires him out or gets him into some foul trouble. So I've got Illinois, but it would need to be a DeSumo show.
Yeah, this team played once down in Champaign, and it was a pretty spicy affair. It was, you know, I don't think these two teams like each other. I think there's some bad blood going back to last season. I do think Garza got in foul trouble a little bit. I think that's the one thing Coburn can do, is he really put Garza in some tough spots where he has to defend. And I agree. I think there's not many teams right now that if Iowa is going to play as well as it does defensively, that I think it can lose to, but Illinois is one of those teams. And that's why I'd pick them here. This is completely boring, by the way, that we're.
Yeah. We probably should show these to each other to figure out if we needed to just say, hey, this is what we both have, or talk about them. But all right. So takes us into Sunday. We got Michigan, Illinois with the championship game. I've got Michigan. I don't actually feel great about it, because I really, really like Illinois. I've been talking about them all year, but I'm still going to take Michigan, just because I think talent-wise, this Michigan team is pretty off the charts.
Yeah, they're bad. I'm going to pick Illinois, and that's not a change. I struggled this one too. I just think Illinois has found something late in the year. They blew out Michigan without Io DeSumo. I think they've got, you know, they've just kind of got an it factor that I think Michigan had midway through the season when they were playing at its best. And they figured it out. I think, you know, wouldn't be shocked to see this team in the Final Four, and I think they're going to be the Big Ten champions. I think also this week, I don't know if you noticed this, their AD came out with a letter to the Illinois.
Oh, yeah, last in the conference.
Last in the conference, and basically declaring themselves regular season champs. How do you feel about that? They were 16-4. Michigan was 14-3. Illinois won the only head-to-head matchup. His point is, you know, we played all of our games. At the very least, we should have been co-champs. How do you feel?
Yeah, I agree with them, only because they played and it was so decisive. But I think I think it was established early on, like, it's going to be all winning percentage. It's all going to be based on this, because we're not going to penalize teams for getting COVID or shutting down because of COVID. Because I think you had to do that from a conference level, because you didn't want teams being like, all right, let's play through this potential outbreak, or let's play and, you know, maybe risk some things because we have a chance to be champions. Like, I think you got to kind of accept it, but I don't mind the AD saying, hey, we like killed them and we finished half a game back. Like, how does this not count when we played more games?
Yeah. And I just think, and that's kind of why I want to see these two teams meet in the final. It would be just a good theater. Both teams having something to play for. I mean, Illinois wanting to prove that, yes, it was the best team in the Big Ten. Michigan wanting to defend its, you know, regular season title. I would love to see that on Sunday. And, you know, who knows? It's crazy. Like, you and I, so separately, went about these picks, and the only non-chalk pick we have is Northwestern in a 13-12 game. Everything else is, you know.
I just think we've seen the Big Ten, like, I mean, yeah, we've seen some weird upsets, like the Michigan State-Michigan game, but I just think we've seen over a body of work here that the teams at the top are the top teams. You can catch them on the right night, but I mean, they are talent-wise and execution-wise, they have separated themselves, and I think that's going to play out here. And now you're making me feel dumb about the Michigan pick, because with the Sumo back, you've got to imagine that Illinois is only stronger. I don't know, I'm going to keep it, yeah, but
I don't know. I wouldn't base things off one game samples. I mean, I just think there was a lot of things in that game that, you know, Illinois just played better that night. I don't know if they're necessarily, if you compare those starting fives, I don't know if they're necessarily better. They have two of the top five players in the league, I think. Michigan, mm-hmm, I think, has three of the top maybe eight players in the league. It's just, that's, if you look at the first two teams, the all Big Ten, at least on my ballot, that's five of the top 10 players in the league right there that are going to be on those teams. So it's not surprising that they're kind of elevating above the rest. So it's, you know, it should be a fun weekend in Indy. There's going to be some high quality basketball. And the thing you wonder is, do they beat themselves up all season long? Do they beat themselves up in the tournament? And then does that have a lingering effect on the NCAA tournament? Cause that's been one theory over the years, is that teams are tired by the time they get to March. And that's why this league hasn't won a title in, you know, since 2000.
It's a fair criticism. I mean, it's hard to argue that, you know, the ACC or like the Big East or some of these other, you know, usual top level conferences, Big 12, their conference tournaments don't also beat themselves up. I mean, it's hard to say that, maybe just because of the depth of the Big Ten. Usually, I mean, this year the middle class has been really strong, stronger, I feel like, than in other seasons. So there might be a stronger argument this year for that. But one other quick question I had for you on this tournament's effect on the NCAA tournament. If our final is what it ends up being, Michigan, Illinois, there's no way a loss for Illinois, let's say, or I guess for either team, would move them off the one line, right?
I don't think so. I think the top four seeds are set.
Yeah, I think so too.
In part because I'm trying to think what two seeds could jump them at this point. You know, even if Iowa makes a run, I don't see them jumping Michigan or Illinois, right? And, you know, I think Iowa's pretty set as a two. I think a lot of the Big Ten teams at the top are kind of set. And you mentioned Ohio State maybe avoiding a drop to the three line. Purdue, I don't know where Purdue sits, four maybe.
Yeah, there are four or five, depending on who you go with. They're a team that could jump up. Let's say they knock off Michigan and Ohio State. I mean, then you would be talking them getting up to the three line. But I'm with you. I think it's going to be tough to move anybody too far down by playing somebody else that's already really good.
One thing to clarify that we talked about last week is, and you kind of mentioned earlier in the show, is like if Wisconsin does end up as an eight or nine seed, they cannot play opposite Illinois or Michigan that first weekend because they've played them twice. Okay. Let's say they end up as a seven seed and Ohio State's the two seed. That is a matchup that in theory could happen that first weekend because they only played once during the regular season. Gotcha. And I saw that in at least one bracket that Wisconsin was the seven and Ohio State is the two. So that's a possibility, but just to kind of give listeners an idea of the rules. Because if they do end up as an eight or nine seed, it'll automatically be Baylor or Gonzaga in that second game.
Gotcha. Let's jump quickly into some football. we're going longer than we expected. Every time I text Jim, hey, we'll go short because I know we're busy. We go about the same as usual. But Wisconsin's pro day is on Wednesday. They're actually about to start activities in about 45 minutes over at McLean in Camp Randall. So I just want to talk just quickly about who you think this day is most important for, because pro days this year are so strange where they're all, everything's going to be on campus. Like even the combine is more going to be about interviews and doing medicals. It's not going to be the usual spectacle of all the running and the tests and stuff. So just to give people an idea, guys that are there, this isn't the full list, but there's guys like Eric Burrell, Isaiah Loudermilk, Mason Stocky, Cole Van Lannen, Rashad Wildgoose, a couple other guys. John Dietzen's going to be there as well. Who do you think can benefit the most from putting out good numbers, at least on their testing today at Wisconsin?
Yeah, I really struggled when you mentioned that we're going to be talking about this. I guess maybe Eric Burrell or even Wildgoose. Like I'm looking at some of those secondary types. If they can have some numbers that maybe raise some eyebrows, does that raise their stock a little bit? I guess that's the only two that came to mind in terms of today being a big difference. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I think the two particular tests that I think are going to be the most important, I think it's going to be Wild Goose is 40, and then it's going to be Cole Van Lannen's bench. And usually bench doesn't matter all that much for offensive linemen, but Van Lannen's in this interesting spot where he doesn't have an apples-to-apples position in the NFL. He played tackle, and he was a very solid tackle for the Badgers last three seasons, but his arms aren't crazy long. He's not like a super freak athlete like you see at a lot of offensive tackles in the NFL level. So does he move into guard? He could. He doesn't maybe have the athleticism laterally that you would want in a guard a lot of times. But I think if he can put up a big number in bench and kind of show the power, because you also have to factor in that he's had a shoulder injury for the last, you know, 2+ years that he's been able to play through and battle through. But if it hinders the amount of strength training he can do and the explosiveness he can get with his punch, I think that's going to scare some teams a little bit, thinking that he could play tackle and, you know, pretty much move him into guard. So I think bench is an important one for Van Lannen. And then Wild Goose with the 40, he's not going to be able to prove his shoulder injury that he sustained at Northwestern this season's fine until he's got pads on and he's able to do things running around. But he can prove the athleticism overall and the speed, which – you think he has. I mean, Jim Leonard was very high on him as not only an outside corner, but as a slot corner as well. But he's got to show pretty, I think, elite level speed to pump him up into the draftable level corners in this draft. Because it's funny, the draft, it always seems like there's, you know, the five or six guys at the top that you know about, but then there's other positions that, you know, don't have depth, or the middle of the group's not very big. Tackle and offensive guard this year, the top's awesome, the middle's awesome, but there's nobody in that bottom level, like the 6 or 7 round guys. And then I think corner is the same way a little bit, where you have some really elite corners that are going to get drafted in the first or second round. Maybe a couple of guys that are from smaller schools that have proven themselves at the Senior Bowl and other things like that, that are going to get into the middle rounds. But the late round corners are more where guys are taking flyers on, you know, some type of skill or some type of speed that they really like. And I think Wild Goose has got to show one of those things in the pre-draft process to try to push him into that draftable level.
What a guy like Isaiah Loudermilk, what are his prospects?
Yeah, it's a great question, because his numbers don't show that he's a great pass rusher, but he's always around the quarterback. So that's where one of those things where the scouting departments are going to see him being in the backfield a lot, just not getting there. And then they got to figure out, okay, is he not there because he didn't get off the block fast enough? He's not fast enough to get to the quarterback, or did the quarterback just get the ball out because they saw this 6'7" monster coming at him, right? And I think that's one of those things too, is that his unique body type and showing the athleticism he did to play that four technique in the 3-4, where he's on top of guards and tackles and rushing the passer, it's pretty rare. And they got to love his long arms. So I think he's got better prospects than I think going into the season. And I read that he's lost a good amount of weight already to try to get quicker. I think that's going to be one of those things where, even if you're worried a little bit about his speed getting to the passer, you're still putting a 6'7" body out there where you put his arms up, it's above 9 feet, right? Like you're talking a pretty tough window to get the ball over. So I think he's going to be somebody that's possibly a sixth, seventh rounder. And then if not a very quick undrafted free agent, kind of like Chris Orr last year, like it's going to be a day three situation, but I think he's got better prospects than I went into his senior year thinking he did.
You mentioned him losing weight. It's always interesting this time of year because you don't see these guys for a couple months usually, right? The bowl game happens. I mean, this year was completely different. But anyways, like you would see these guys in person after the bowl game, and then you don't see them again for 2 months until pro day. And then you show up, and some of them have transformed their bodies quite a bit. So that's always an interesting to see what they did in those 8 weeks to change their bodies. And some of it, sometimes it's a pretty radical change.
Right. So we'll be covering all that on Madison.com. You guys can go check that out. And then obviously all of Jim's basketball preview stuff is up there as well. And lots of stuff coming on Thursday as that game gets closer. Of course, I was going to laugh when the bracket came out. Of course, you got to drive down there and then have all night games up into potential championship, which isn't all that likely.
Yeah. I mean, like, I guess I can admit this now publicly, like selfishly, I was hoping that Wisconsin would somehow end up as the seventh seed. That would make my life a lot easier. I know probably not better for them necessarily, but easier for me because the 5:30 Central start on Thursday and Friday, if they get that far, would have been much better than the what's looking like probably 8:15 start. It's just a nightmare deadline scenario. So, but whatever. Sometimes we've lucked out over the years a lot of times in that they end up in that, you know, that 4 seed or 5 seed and or 1 seed, you know, where the games are early. So over the course of time, we've certainly been luckier than not lucky. So I guess it just evens out.
Gotcha. All right. So make sure you're on Madison.com checking all that stuff out. Make sure you're following Jim on Twitter, Jim Polzine, WSJ. Follow me on Twitter as well, CBart WSJ. Lots of stuff coming up this weekend. Like we said, big weekend with the Big Ten tournament. Hockey, men's hockey. I know you guys love Todd having on here. Men's hockey's, I believe, yeah, they're entering the Big Ten tournament as well this weekend.
Big Ten tournament, yeah.
Yeah, and then the women are off. They got a week gap between now and their NCAA tournament. So busy March as always. Lots of stuff coming. Make sure you're following along. But for Jim Polzine, I'm Colton Bartholomew. Thank you guys very much for listening.